All right, well, it's good to see everybody here this morning. Thank you for being here. I appreciate your presence. I'm going to pick up where I left off in my previous lesson entitled Know Your Enemy. And part one of that, I introduced you to our enemy, the enemy of every child of God, the enemy of everybody who's trying to do what's right, trying to serve the Lord, is, of course, Satan. Sun Tzu, in his famous seminal work, The Art of War, 2,500 years ago, said that that's one of the keys of winning the war is first know your enemy. And then you know how to defeat him, because you have to understand what he's up to and who he is. Today I want to talk about Satan, his origin, and why it matters. The passage that David just read to you from 2 Samuel chapter 15, I'm going to go back and give you the background of that chapter if you're not familiar with it. It's about Absalom, the son of David, King David in the Old Testament. But I want to suggest to you it's really about Satan. And I'll show you why in a few minutes, but that story on its surface is a story of David and Absalom and their struggle for the kingdom and all of that. But if you follow the story carefully, you'll see that it's really about Christ and Satan. And that's where the story really ends up if you follow it far enough. That's why that's in there. I'll come back to that in a few minutes. Satan's origin and why it matters. That's what I want to talk about this morning. Let's dig right into it. But before I do that, I want to just review a couple things I said last time when I was talking about this topic. What we don't see here on the surface, looking around ourselves, looking at the everyday events of life, is we don't see behind the curtains, because all we have is this mortal life. We have this physical existence that we go through, and we don't see all the things going on in the spiritual realm. Paul said in Ephesians 6 and verse 10, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places." There's a lot going on that is beyond the surface of what we see here in this everyday life. And I want us to pull back the curtain a little bit and see it. Because when you see it, and I mean figuratively seeing it, but when you start to see it, you realize there's something going on here that we need to be aware of. It's not just about what we see with our own eyes here in front of us. That's why Paul puts that in there. So you know that you're not just, it's not just about you and what you see around you. The spiritual battle that we fight sometimes gets mischaracterized or misunderstood because we're leaving out an important character in the process. When I struggle against problems here in this life, sometimes I'm tempted to wonder, well, why is God doing this to me? Why do I have to struggle against all these things God is doing? And folks, it's not a struggle between me and God, or between you and God. If you're a child of God, you're not struggling against God. He's on your side. He's working for you, not against you. If I'm struggling against things, it isn't me against me, where I have these things in my mind or these temptations, and I have to fight with myself to get things right. It's not a battle between me and me. It isn't a battle between me against you. You're doing something to me, and I'm doing something to you, and we have to fight against each other. It isn't me against the bad people. I know they're out there and they may be doing things to me, but that's not really what it's about. And it certainly isn't, for example, against Christians, against persecuting governments, although that's what it appears to be on the surface. When governments persecute Christians, there's that conflict and that struggle, but that's not really what it's about. There's somebody else involved that we've left out if that's all we see. It's me and you and Jesus against Satan, because Satan is behind all those things that are trying to stop us from serving God. That's who wants us not to serve God. That's who wants to stop us along the way. That's who wants to put obstacles in the path. That's who wants us to fail and not make it to the promised land. That's the spiritual battle, and that's what's really going on. And we need to recognize who the real enemy really is. Last time I talked about the fact that Satan is a real entity. He's not a cartoon character. A lot of cartoon things get depicted of him, and sometimes we think that's all he is. He's not simply a made-up character to scare people into obedience. The Bible describes words, thoughts, actions, designs, schemes, and things to him, describing him as a real personality, a real entity who's really out there somewhere, really doing some things. And so we need to take him seriously. And he is not just the personification of evil, but an intelligent being. And Paul talks about this in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, where he says that we need to be aware of the schemes, the devices of Satan, and not let him take advantage of us. And that we shouldn't be ignorant of his devices. We need to recognize these out to get us. And therefore, we need to know our enemy. as Sun Tzu would say. Know your enemy. And don't be ignorant of his devices. Let's be aware of who Satan is and what he's up to. So this morning I want to continue by talking about the origin of Satan. Inside that box is everything the Bible says about how Satan originated. Oh, the box is empty. Yeah, the Bible doesn't ever contain a passage that says, on this date in such and such BC, here's what happened, here's how Satan got started. The Bible doesn't ever come out and say that. So that's everything the Bible says about it. So my lesson is not over at this point, unfortunately. We can draw some inferences, however, about the origin of Satan. The Bible teaches by inference. Jesus taught by inference, and he drew inferences from passages and said that that's a valid way to reason from the Scriptures. So there are inferences that we can draw from the Scriptures about how Satan must have originated, or at least some things that we can be pretty sure about. So let's talk about those and talk about the origin of Satan. Then we'll talk about why it matters. And there's some things I want you to take home. This is not just a theological exercise. There are things I want you to take home from this lesson that'll help you in your everyday walk with the Lord based on learning about Satan and his origins and who he is and what he's up to. I think there's some things that we must infer about Satan. One is that he must have been created at some point. He's not self-existing. He's not equal with God. In describing, the first description of Satan is in Genesis 3, and it says that God created this thing that is described as Satan. Genesis 3 and verse 1, the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden. Satan must have been created at some point because he's not God. And God is, of course, the only thing that can be self-existing. That's always been and exists simply in and of himself. And it never had a beginning point. And that's the characteristic of deity. But Satan is not deity. He's not God. And he's not equal to God. And I think the next inference that I would draw from that is that he must have been good when he was created. Because I don't think it's possible for God to, that God could have or would have created someone or something contrary to his own nature. And the reason I say it is because it's in passages like this. James chapter 1 verse 13 says, let no one say when he's tempted, I'm tempted by God. Okay, that goes back to what I said earlier. Remember at the beginning of my lesson, I said that the enemy is not God. God is not the one out there putting temptations in front of us to try to distract us from serving him. God's not doing that. Satan's doing that. Okay? God doesn't tempt anyone. God is not tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. Each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. However Satan originated, I think he had to have started out good and then turned evil at some point. God didn't make him that way because God doesn't do that. He doesn't want people to be evil. He doesn't make people be evil. But people become evil because of choices made by the sinner. The sinner chooses because of his own desires to turn against God. And Satan must have done that at some point in the ancient past. 1 John chapter 1 and verse 5 says, God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. I don't think God could or would make somebody as a dark, evil being, because that's inconsistent with his nature, and he just doesn't do those kind of things. All right, well, given those inferences about Satan's origin, I want to show you also, this is not an inference, this is a fact, and we have a Bible passage that says this, that others besides humans who once were good have chosen to turn against God. It isn't just humanity that has turned against God, has fallen away from the good state that humans were created in back in the Garden of Eden and back in Genesis chapter 1, 2, and 3. Humanity is not the only ones who have fallen away from that perfect state that God created them in. Jude 1, chapter 1, verse 6 says, angels who did not keep their proper domain but left their own abode, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day. Now, the Bible doesn't come out and say that's where Satan originated. That's possible, but the Bible doesn't come out and say that. 2 Peter 2 and verse 4, for if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them in the chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. And he goes on to talk about the conclusions you could reach from that. My point is simply this. Humans are not the only ones who have been created good and fallen away. The Bible says that angels also, some of them, were created good, but then fell away and turned against God. So it's entirely likely that that's where Satan originated from as well. Well, all right, given those inferences, I want to turn to some passages and talk about passages that are really not talking about the origin of Satan, but they're often turned to as if they were. And I want to clear up some misunderstandings of those. One of the most common that you'll see in books of theology or in popular literature or whatever it may be is Isaiah chapter 14. And Isaiah 14, it was written in the 700s BC time frame. Isaiah is talking to the nation of Israel, and he's talking about the fact that they're going to go into captivity. The Babylonians are going to capture the nation of Israel and destroy them, and all the kind of bad things are going to happen. But redemption was coming, and judgment was going to come upon Babylon. So they weren't going to win in the end. Babylonians were bad guys, but they were going to take over the nation of Israel and destroy them. But God was then going to judge Babylon later on, because Babylonians are bad guys. And judgment was coming. And so that's what the prophet Isaiah is talking about. Isaiah 14:12 is sometimes quoted out of context, where it says, "How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you are cut down to the ground." It talks about how this great figure is exalted himself to the heavens, and then God cuts him down and sends him down to the dust and the earth and below the ground, and all kind of bad things can happen to him. The problem is, if you just read a couple of verses earlier, the context says, "You'll take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say how the oppressor has ceased, the golden city has ceased." And then you keep reading, and that's who he's talking about when he talks about how Lucifer was going to be cut down. It's talking about the king of Babylon. It's not talking about Satan. So that passage really doesn't apply to Satan. Maybe it's a parable that's similar, but it's not really talking about Satan in the context. Another passage that sometimes gets quoted out of context as far as the origin of Satan is Revelation chapter 12. And all I've done is summarize it here. I don't have time to read the whole chapter, but I'll summarize it. In Revelation 12, John sees a vision. And he sees a vision of the woman who gives birth to a male child. We all know who that is. That's Jesus. Satan shows up to devour the child. That's what. Remember King Herod? Remember the story of Herod and baby Jesus? And Herod sends out the wise men come to Jerusalem to find out where is the Christ to be born. And Herod hears about it, and he says, "Well, find out where he is." And they tell him, "Oh, Bethlehem." And he says, "Well, come back and tell me so I can worship him too." Well, Herod has no intention of worshiping him. He's going to kill him. So Herod sends men down to Bethlehem to kill baby Jesus, but Jesus gets away. They go to Egypt. All that stuff. Satan wants to destroy Jesus, but he can't do it. He tries, but he can't. The child will rule the nations with a rod of iron. Of course, that's Jesus. Jesus is the Messiah. He's the great king. He's going to rule the nations. And that's a quote from Psalm 2, verses 7 through 9, where it predicted that the Son of God would reign over the nations with a rod of iron. The child was caught up to heaven, to God's throne. Well, that's Jesus. He was caught up to heaven to sit on the throne with his Father. The woman flees to the wilderness. There's war in heaven, and Satan and his angels fight with the angels of God. Okay? This is talking about something that happens as a result of the work of Jesus. Satan loses the battle, he's cast down to earth, and then Satan goes and declares war on God's people, starts attacking and persecuting Christians. All right? This whole context is talking about conflict that occurs between God and Satan because of the great work that Jesus does at the cross. It's not talking about the origin of Satan, because in the context, it's talking about Jesus, everything that he did in his great atonement in the first century. So keep it in its context, and don't try to move it back to before the book of Genesis. But it's talking about the work of Jesus in the first century. This one, the story that David summarized or partially read there in 2 Samuel 15, also tells the story of Satan, although Satan's name isn't mentioned anywhere in it. And I want to focus on this for the next few minutes, because I think the story of David and Absalom tells us more about Satan than many of the other things that we've just looked at. So I want to spend a few minutes talking about the story of David and Absalom. Let's talk about the characters for a moment. In the Old Testament, King David, king of Israel, second king of Israel, King Saul was the first. Saul was faulty. He didn't do God's will all the time. And God replaced him with David. And David was the man after God's own heart. He was the man who had every intention in his heart of doing God's will and really trying to uphold God's laws and lead the people in righteousness and justice and be what God wanted him to be. He was the gold standard of kings in the Old Testament. Sometimes they would talk about kings. Well, he was a king like David. He did what God's will, or he wasn't like David because he didn't do God's will. David was the gold standard of kings of Israel in the Old Testament. But David has some problems. And there's a point in David's life where he stumbles. And that is, he commits adultery with Bathsheba and kills her husband, takes her to be his own wife. And God catches up with him. Of course, God saw the whole thing, sends a prophet to rebuke him about it. And the prophet tells him that God will forgive him for his sin, but there's going to be some problems. And the problems are going to be violence within his own family. And sure enough, in the years that follow, violence rises up in David's family. Some of his sons come in conflict with each other. And there's bloodshed and violence. And one of the things that happens in the course of time is that David's son Absalom comes along. And the Bible says in 2 Samuel, and I would urge you to go to read, I don't have time to read the whole story, it takes too long. But you can read the story of Absalom, 2 Samuel chapter, starting in about chapter 12, 13, somewhere in that area, chapter 13. And then read about five or six chapters. It's a lengthy story, but it's worth reading. Absalom is described in 2 Samuel chapter 14, verse 25. It says, "In all Israel, there was no one who was praised as much as Absalom for his good looks." Oh, boy. He was the best-looking guy in the whole country. All right? The original Prince Charming, if you will. Okay? Now, he's the son of the king. Okay. All right. Well, I want to stop here for a moment and remind you that not only is King David the best king ancient Israel ever had, he's also a model for Christ. Because everything that King David represented, everything King David tried to do, that is become the great leader of God's people, defeat the enemies of God's people, destroy the bad guys that were afflicting God's people, lead the people in righteousness, all those things that David was trying to do that he represented are all things that Christ would do. Defeat the enemies of God's people, lead the people in righteousness, be the man after God's own heart. David was imperfectly the man after God's own heart, but Jesus was perfectly the man after God's own heart. Always did God's will every day in his life. And there are at least four Old Testament prophets who predicted that the Messiah would be a second coming of King David. In fact, he's even called the son of David because he's quite literally the genealogical descendant of David, but he's also spiritually takes after David. He does the things that David did in the spiritual realm, in the new covenant. Jesus is the son of David. So he's the fulfillment of everything that David stood for in the Old Testament. So keep that in mind as you read this. David is he's a man, he's the king of Israel, but he's also playing a role. He's playing a role as the figure for Christ. And he has a good-looking son who wants to take his place. All right. He's very good-looking. He wants the kingdom for himself. You can read about that in chapter 15 and verse 4. He said, Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land. Everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me instead of who? King David." He wants to take the place of King David, his father. He wants everybody to come to him. He wants to reign over Israel and be the king and take the place of his father. Let me ask you a very simple question. In the great scheme of things, Jesus, of course, is our king. He's the king over God's kingdom today, but who wants to replace him? Who really wants to be the king and who shouldn't be? Satan wants the kingdom for himself, doesn't he? That's why Satan does what he does. He wants people to not to be in the Lord's kingdom, to be in his kingdom. He wants the power and the glory that only Jesus should have. Satan wants to take that power away from him, have people serve him instead of Jesus. That's what Absalom wanted. Absalom's good looking. Let me ask you a question. Preacher, I think I said this last time. The preacher in the church I attended growing up used to say, if Satan really looked like all those cartoons, it'd be easy to recognize. Nobody'd do his will. Satan is good looking. Satan can be very attractive. That's why people do his will, because it looks attractive. New Testament says that Satan could even appear as an angel of light. That's how attractive he could be. Absalom was good looking. Absalom wants the kingdom for himself, just like Satan does, and Absalom tells lies. Chapter 15 and verse 3, he intercepts people who are coming to Jerusalem to meet with the king over their problems. That's what kings are supposed to do. They're supposed to solve the problems of the people. But he intercepts them on the way and said, "Oh, don't bother going to talk to the king. No, don't bother. He's too busy. Nobody here to hear your case. Oh, you know, if I were king, why, I'd take it. But there's, David, he can't hang." Yeah. So he lies about King David. Tells people that he'd do a better job. What does Satan do? When Jesus came in the first century, what did people do about him? What did the Jewish leaders do about Jesus? They lied about him, didn't they? False criticism, made up false charges and false accusations, told people not to listen to Jesus with false criticism. and distracted the people away from Jesus to try to stop them from going to him to accept him as their king. Absalom wants the kingdom for himself, and he uses good looks and deception. Later on, he's going to use violence and persecution. Who else uses that to get people into his kingdom? Satan will do that too, doesn't he? Satan uses violence and persecution to get people to stay in his kingdom and not go into the kingdom of Christ. Absalom will do that too. In this manner, verse 6, Absalom acted toward all Israel, came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Absalom was able to pull people away from King David and get them into his kingdom because he wanted to take the kingdom away from King David. The majority of Israel believed Absalom's lies and rejected David as their king and chose Absalom instead. What happened in the first century Israel? The majority of Israel rejected Jesus as their king. And who did they serve instead? Well, they said, "We have no king but Caesar." Who was Caesar serving? I'll give you a hint. Satan. Little hint there. Yeah. They chose Satan as their king instead of Jesus. In chapter 18 of 2 Samuel, we don't have time to read it, but Absalom declared war on King David. His own father declared war on him. And war breaks out. David's men win the battle. Look over at chapter 18 of verse 3. This is something I just noticed. And Vince, if we do second edition of Road to Emmaus, we're going to put this in there. In chapter 18 of verse 3, there's the battle. They're about to have the battle between Absalom and David's men over the kingdom. They're fighting over the kingdom. But an interesting thing happens in verse 3. The people, they're talking to King David, and they're trying to decide how they're going to fight the battle with Absalom. And this is David's people who are supporting David. David says in verse 2, the king said to the people, "I also will surely go out with you myself. I'm going to go right there, right on the battlefield and fight with you." That's what David says. But David's people say, "Well, wait a minute, David. Don't do that. Don't come out there with us." Verse 3, "You shall not go out, for if we flee away, they will not care about us, nor if half of us die, will they care about us. You are with 10,000 of us now, for you are much more help to us in the city." The king said to them, "Whatever seems best to you, I will do." So the king stood beside the gate. All the people went out by hundreds and by thousands. Let me ask you a question. As citizens of the kingdom of Christ today, how do we fight the battle against Satan? Where's Jesus? Is he right here in this room helping us fight the battle with Satan? Well, I wish he was. It'd be nice. No, he's in heaven. Now, figuratively, spiritually, yes, he's with us every day. I'm not knocking that at all. I'm not putting that down. But he's not here physically with us. He's gone back to the Father. He ascended back to the Father. And we go out and fight the battle while he stays in heaven with the Father, encouraging us, supporting us. But he's not here physically with us. Just like King David stays behind, supports them, encourages them, but they have to go fight the battle on his behalf. That's what we have to do. We have to go out and fight that battle against the enemy of the king without our king being physically here with us, just like they did. Interesting parallel. King says, all right. They go out and fight the battle, and guess what happens? They win. They win the battle. They overcome Absalom. They defeat him. What's going to happen at the end? When this is all over, we finish all these battles against Satan, and everything's all done in the end, who wins the battle? We already know. You know who's going to win the battle between Christ and Satan. Christ is going to win the battle. We have to fight it, but Christ will win. There's an interesting statement, though. That is that before the battle started, David says something to his men. He says, "I want you to deal gently with Absalom. Don't kill him." So they go out and they fight the battle, and Absalom is caught in the battle. They trap him. Joab, the commander of David's army, hears that Absalom's been caught. And he says, "Well, why didn't you kill him?" Well, to the men, "Well, because David said not to." "Are you? Go kill him." And they go and kill Absalom contrary to David's instructions. And David mourns for Absalom, cries because of his great loss of his son. Now, in the great scheme of things, this is an interesting story in the Old Testament. David wins. He's restored to the kingdom. And he does an interesting thing after it's all over. You know what David does? He forgives everyone that fought against him. Forgives everyone that turned against him. Let me ask you something. What did Jesus do? When Jesus wins the battle, takes his kingdom, what does Jesus do to everybody that's ever fought against him if they want to come back to his kingdom? Doesn't he forgive everybody that's fought against him? If you fought against Jesus in the past, if you want to come back into his kingdom, you can. He'll forgive you, just like David did in the Old Testament. But here's the thing. When David mourns over Absalom, I think there's something going on here. And that is, remember the roles that they're playing. David plays the role of Christ, Absalom plays the role of Satan. And as I read that, I think, how did God feel when Satan turned against him? He must have mourned. He must have been so upset and sorry that this great one who had been such a leader and had such great promise, such great possibility, as Absalom could have. Absalom could have been a great leader in David's kingdom. Could have been. But he threw it all away for this useless rebellion, sinful rebellion, and he ends up buried under a pile of rocks, doomed for eternity. That's where Absalom ends up. Where does Satan going to end up? Same kind of place, doomed for eternity. Whereas he could have been a beloved son of the king. He could have been a great leader in David's kingdom. And I wonder if that's not a picture of how God felt about Satan when Satan turned against him, that he mourned and thought, oh, how sad this is that someone who could have been so great turned against him. Anyway, I think the story of David and Absalom is the story of Christ and Satan, and I urge you to read it with that in mind. Now, how does this affect us? What Satan and Absalom both wanted, Absalom wanted the power of King David. Satan wants the power of God. One of the temptations, the three great temptations that Jesus was offered in the wilderness when he was fasting after his baptism, he went off in the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Matthew 4, verse 8 says, the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And Satan tips his hand a little bit here. You know, Satan's not honest very often. In fact, he lies most of the time. But every now and then he says something that betrays who he really is. He says something to Jesus here. He says, I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world if you will fall down and worship me. Oh, yeah. That's what Satan really wants. He gives it away. I want the power of God. I want you to fall down and worship me. Because that's what he really wants. He wants the power of God. And it upsets Jesus because it upsets Satan. Every time a sinner turns to Christ. Colossians 1:13 says God, has delivered us, Christians, from the power of darkness and conveyed us, Christians, into the kingdom of the Son of his love. When we exit the kingdom of Satan by obeying the gospel, we leave the power of darkness. Satan has power. Power of darkness. He's got his kingdom, the kingdom of darkness. Everybody that's a sinner, that's lost, is in his kingdom. But when we obey the gospel, we're conveyed out of the power of darkness. We leave Satan's power, and we end up in the kingdom of the Son of his love. We're in the kingdom of Jesus now. Satan doesn't like that. He doesn't like losing power over people. He doesn't want people to exit his kingdom. It makes him mad. He wants everybody to fall down and worship him. When we leave his kingdom, we weaken his power. I want to suggest to you that this is the root of sin right here. And again, Satan tips his hand a little bit. In the first temptation recorded in the Bible, the very first temptation of Eve in Genesis 3, the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die. That's a lie. God told her, if you eat the fruit that's in the midst of the garden I told you not to eat of, the day you eat thereof, you will surely die. Satan comes like, oh no, you will not surely die. He lies to her. For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. The first temptation Satan offers anybody is that you can be like God. I want to suggest to you that isn't that exactly what Satan wanted for himself? When he says, if you fall down and worship me, Because I want to be like God. I want the power that only God has. So fall down and worship me. And he offers that to Eve. You'll be like God if you do this. She falls for it. As Satan has fallen for it. Satan somehow believes that he can be like God. Here's what I want you to take home as I wrap this up. This is why it matters. This is what I want you to think about on the way home today. What does it imply if someone who stands in the presence of God, okay, and I'm talking about Satan, in whatever form he was back before he turned against God, but what does it tell you about someone if they could stand in the literal, miraculous, glorious presence of God and right to his face tell him, I'm not going to serve you? But what does that say about his mindset or his heart? How depraved and how evil do you have to be able to say that directly to God in his presence? How hard do you have to be? How bad do you have to be or have become to do that? How scary that would be. I can't imagine doing that. But here's the question I want you to take home. What does it imply if we do it? Even though we're not standing in God's face, in a miraculous presence, we don't see him. So it's a little bit easier for us to do it, isn't it? When we choose the way of sin, in some sense, aren't we? Aren't we saying to God, I just don't feel like doing things your way. I'll just do my own thing. Thanks. Isn't that what we're saying to him? Aren't we acting just like Satan when we do that? The difference, I think, between us and Satan, if there is a difference, is that we still have a chance to be redeemed. There is no redemption. There is no plan of salvation for Satan. Hebrews 2 and verse 16 says that. He does not give aid to angels, but he does give aid to the seed of Abraham. There's no plan of salvation for them. In fact, the problem is if we continue down that path, we can be redeemed now. But if time runs out, we step into eternity unredeemed, unsaved, unreconciled to God, not having obeyed the gospel, not having found forgiveness in the blood of Christ, then we will have done the same thing Satan and his angels have done, and we will share the same fate that the devil and his angels will share. That's what Matthew 25, 41 says. He will say to those on his left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. Because we did the same thing they did. We started out good, we turned against God and told him, we don't care about your ways, don't care about your will, I'm going to do my own thing. And if we say that to God, we share the fate of others who have done the same thing. And that's what I want you to think about this morning. Let's not go down the same path as Satan has gone down. Let's choose to reject the way of Satan. Let's choose to reject his deceptions. Let's choose to exit the kingdom of Satan if that's where we are this morning. And if we're in the kingdom of Christ, let's choose to stay in the kingdom of Christ by doing the Lord's will and refusing any deception of Satan that says it's okay to ignore God's will and do what we want to do. And every day choose to try to imitate the example of King David, if you will, to be the man after God's own heart. Let's choose to do that. Let's be the man or woman after God's own heart. And every day, choose to do his will, not our own. Would you join me in prayer for just a moment, please?